This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello, and welcome to episode 207. I'm Chris Stafford. Our guest today is Tick Maynard, who has just released a new book entitled In the Middle Are the Horsemen, which is published by Trafalgar Books and available next week. Tick tells the story of how his career as a horseman developed, who influenced him along the way. We hear about how he connects with horses to develop a partnership using his own horsemanship techniques and how that translates into training competition horses. Well, Tick joins me now. Tick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about your book about to be released and get into sort of the techniques, really, the horsemanship side of things and pick your brains there. But before we do, let's backpedal a little bit to the catalyst for this. Why were you inspired to write a book in the first place?
Well, in 2008, I decided I wanted to become a working student. I was a little old. I think I was 25 or 26. To become a working student, but it's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go overseas and to Germany and then maybe work for some people in the United States as well. And at the time, there was a little magazine, well, there still is a little magazine in British Columbia called Gatepost Magazine, and they specialize in all kinds of hunter-jumper and also eventing and dressage stuff that's going on. And I asked them if they'd be interested in having me write a little article about my experience as a working student, and they said they would. And when I wrote that, I called it Chapter 1. And then, you know, what naturally followed was that there would be a Chapter 2. And over the course of the next year, I wrote a few for that magazine. And then I also then switched and started writing those same kind of chapters, blogs type things for Chronicle of the Horse, which is obviously based out of Middleburg in the United States. And then I continued doing that for a few years, and then I stopped. But when I got approached by Trafalgar Square Books about doing a book, my first thought was, why don't we take a collection of these articles that I've already written and sort of make them into a book, which is essentially what I've done.
I'd like to understand what your philosophy is for horsemanship, Tick, and where that originated, because we all have a starting base. We all have a foundation for where we develop our horsemanship. What was yours?
Well, that's a good question. I think I'll start off by saying that when I look at other people that I admire, you know, I might think that they have similar ways of doing things, or if they're good, they believe in similar theories. But I also believe that every single person has a slightly different philosophy about working with horses. Even, you know, even with me and Sinead, or if you look at David and Karen O'Connor, or you look at Pat and Linda Pirelli, or whoever you're looking at, I think everybody's slightly different. And you start to see that in how far they will push, or how quickly they'll come along, or what their priorities are at any given moment. And I think my biggest influence growing up was obviously my parents and Pony Club and competing in the jumpers and competing in Prince Philip Games. And from that background, you're trying to get something done. And when I got interested in more horsemanship or natural horsemanship stuff, a lot of times people go a lot slower, and they won't think twice about going in a clinic where it's an 8-hour clinic. Whereas if you ask a hunter jumper person to go in a clinic, they're used to, you know, an hour and a half clinic. And it's a very different mindset that, you know, we've got a certain amount of time to spend with our horse and we're going to get it done. And so I had these two opposing views, you know, over the past few years. And Bruce Logan, a guy that I worked for in Texas, you know, best summed it up from his point of view. And he said, on one hand, you've got people that are trying to compete and trying to win, and they got to make a living from it. And on the other hand, you've got people that, you know, are real amateurs, and they're on no timeline at all. And he said to him, the horsemen are in the middle. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. And that's also the title of the book.
Yeah, it's a great title. So when you think about being in the middle then on a daily basis, when you go out to work a horse, where is your mindset? Do you leave your watch in the barn?
No, I don't. And I'd probably like to, but because of, you know, for a lot of people, horses aren't just for fun. They're ways to make a living. So you've got to ride a certain number of horses in a day, or you've got to teach a certain number of lessons, or you've got to sell a horse or compete a horse. And you have to be a little bit aware of the clock. And I think as I get more experience, I'm able to pick, you know, say I've got 45 minutes, how much I'm going to be able to get done in that amount of time without pushing it. And I also think the big thing that I've started doing more and more with horses, and the more experience I get, the better I get at it, is being able to compromise with them. And a lot of times when people see, you know, a horse in their mind getting away with something with me, then they get upset and they say the horse will learn that. And I don't believe that. I mean, I think a horse can learn that and it can become a habit. But just because a horse does something once doesn't mean it's going to become a habit. And the best example I can give with that is when a horse, when I've got a very green horse that's learning to jump and it stops at a jump, I will let it stop. And I will just give it a pat and I'll say, hey, maybe that was a little new or that was a little big. Why don't we go do something easier and then come again? And a lot of people, when they see that, they say, oh my God, I can't believe you're letting the horse stop at that jump. It's going to start learning to stop. But it's not. Maybe if you let it stop 8 times, it will. But if you progressively build it up and it just stops once when it's very young, you know, that's not a habit yet. That's not a big deal at all to me.
I know, Tick, you know, when we start a career with horses, and you mentioned you came to the pretty late, you know, like myself, we travel the world, we learn from so many different people, riders, trainers, coaches around the world, and at the elite level, and you're inspired by those, and you take away from those what you will, you kind of pick what inspires you from those learnings. At what point do you think you reached a tipping point where you felt that you were now developing your own style, and how would you characterize that?
I like that. I think, you know, everybody, I really think everybody should start off as a working student. I think it's such a great way, whether, you know, it's for your trainer or you go out and travel or it's for your parents if you're that lucky. And I think it's great to have that foundation. I think too often you see people just taking once a week lessons or just doing clinics. And when you're in that situation, what happens is you learn stuff that can be taught in one lesson or in 2 or 3 days. Because if you meet a good clinician, what they're going to do is they're going to pick with the people in that clinic something that they can fix in 2 or 3 days. And there is a lot of stuff you can fix, you know, in one lesson or in one clinic. But sometimes there's stuff with horses that takes months or years to fix. And you don't really get into those things unless you're in a program for months or years. You don't really see how those things are addressed on a day-to-day basis. And I think I was lucky enough to spend time with my parents growing up, and they were like that. And then also with Sinead now, Sinead's an excellent horseman. But at the same time, I've been able to see what other people are doing and incorporate it into my own business. For me personally, when I set off on my own, it was when I was working for people, and I just always was thinking, you know, this is great, but if I had my own barn, I'd do this just a little bit differently. And once you start saying that enough times, then it's time to hang out your own shingle, because like I said at the the beginning, everybody has a slightly different philosophy, and that's where it starts to come into play.
And now, of course, you have developed your own philosophy, and in terms of approaching the horse, then let's talk about that and your techniques, how you would characterize the techniques that you use when you want to develop a partnership with a horse. Maybe it's a horse that you're seeing for the first time, or a young horse that you've known as a baby, and now you're going to start working it.
Yeah, a lot of times I try to be very flexible first off. So, you know, depending on what equipment I've got with me, whether I've got a horseman's stick or a flag or a lariat, or I've got just a regular leather halter and a rope, or maybe I'm in a situation where I don't have any of that, but I've got a round pen. So I try to learn all kinds of different ways of doing stuff and then apply what's needed best in the moment. But given a perfect situation, I virtually always get to know a horse first by doing groundwork with the horse. And it just gives me a chance to be able to see how they move, what their energy level is like, what their anxiety level is like, where their mind's at. It gives me a chance to see what they're motivated by. You know, some horses are motivated by just wanting to rest. Other horses are motivated by play. Other horses are, you know, quite anxious and they need to run in order to relax second. Other horses, you know, just the relaxation and being able to stand still is a reward. So it really gives me a chance to get to know them. And some horses I'll do groundwork with for one day, sometimes even less than one session. And other horses I'll continue to do groundwork with for, you know, weeks or even months, just kind of depending on what that horse needs.
So let's compare it then to the methods of yesteryear in a way, because I don't think so many people use driving, long reining, as much. When you say groundwork, you're not so much talking about long reining as you're talking about loose work?
Yeah, so you're right. A lot of people, you know, are used to traditional lunging and ground driving, even with reins on either side of the horse. And you're right, I don't do much of that. Usually what I use is either a 12 or a 22-foot rope, and it's like sort of a yachting material, so it's a little bit heavier, and you can send a signal down it. And I do groundwork. You know, for people that are being introduced to it, you know, the most famous people that are doing this now are like Buck Brannaman or Pat Pirelli or Clinton Anderson. And, you know, what I do is a little bit similar to some of those people, although I've kind of developed my own thing as I go. And essentially what we're doing is we're teaching the horse to yield to different kinds of pressures. You know, can they yield their hindquarters? Can they yield their forehand? Can they yield their head? Can they go out on a circle? Can they turn in? And when you're first learning this, that's essentially what you see, is you see how the person is working around the horse and how that horse moves and reacts to the person. But what's happening on a deeper level is essentially that the horse is learning to think first and to react second. Too often, horses, which of course they know in the wild and is what keeps them alive, is that they react first and think second. We want to change that mindset in order to have a horse be a good competition horse with us. Is we want them to go into a situation that they've never seen before, or go into, you know, a big stadium maybe in Lexington, Kentucky, and they see flags and they see judges, and when they see something they're not used to because of the way they've been brought along, they say, oh, that's interesting, or oh, that's new. They don't just react and want to run. There's actually, you know, a little thought that goes through their mind first.
Well, there's another comparison. I'm curious as to how you then take it to the next level, which is confidence. And when I was back in the day, bringing on young horses, breaking them in and bringing them on, I would long rein them for miles around English country lanes, where they would always be in front of you, of course, and develop that confidence. And I always used to say I'd wear a set of shoes out on them before I ever got on their back. If you take that old method, that pre-method, which I don't think is used as much these days, of having the horse in front of you because he develops confidence himself. They see things, they learn to pass that tractor or pass the elephant in the driveway. How do you do that with your method, Tick? Developing confidence.
Yeah, well, first I like to think that there's two ways to develop confidence in horses. And one way is to have a progressive, you know, systematic way where they always achieve success, like a million little tiny milestones where they're successful every time. And so, you know, that'd be like if you're getting a horse used to water jumps, you take them first to just look at one, and then they're successful, and then you get a little closer and they're successful, and then they can put their nose on it, and then they're successful, and then they can, you know, walk through it or over it, and then they're successful. So they have all these little tiny milestones. The second way that I think a horse can achieve, can gain confidence, is by going through something difficult and coming out okay on the other side. So that would be the situation where you come up to the water, and instead of having a lot of little tiny milestones, they don't want to go through it, and you say, no, we're going to work through this, and like I believe in you, and it's a little difficult for them, and then they go through it, and then they go, like, they take a big sigh and they go, oh, that wasn't so bad, and they come out okay on the other side. So the first thing is you look at every individual horse, or I look at every individual horse, and I think, you know, where are they at on this spectrum, on this scale of how confident they are about things. And ideally, I think the kinder way is to have all these progressive little milestones. But once in a while, I think it's also not a big deal to work through something difficult with a horse and say, hey, you can do this. It's going to be real tough, but you can do it. The trick, of course, is if you get into that and it's not okay on the other side, you've actually made it worse. So that's where you might see somebody, you know, you want them, like you said, you're out on the trail and you want them to get used to, say, a tractor. And you say, hey, you got to get used to this. You're going to lead the way. And then all of a sudden, you know, it gets to be too much for you, or it's overwhelming for the horse, and then it doesn't end up okay on the other side. And that's where you see horses, you know, developing more fear, less confidence, and it's probably even worse off than if you hadn't taken them out at all. which is why it's so much easier, you know, for horses that I get to start a green horse than a horse that's been started by, you know, somebody else, and then they've run into problems because the horse has already learned bad habits. They've learned to be afraid of stuff rather than to build confidence about it.
So let's take this then to early competition training. Give us some ideas, Tick, of your methods then, those first fundamentals.
Well, I think probably the biggest thing that is a big priority for me with young horses and when I start competing is that I try to always have my horse relaxed enough to start doing what they're going to do. And I've got a scale in my mind of 1 to 10 on how relaxed a horse is. You know, often when I teach a jump lesson, for example, I'll ask my students, I'll say, is your horse relaxed and ready to start jumping? And they might say yes or no. And to them, it's almost a yes or no answer. But for me, I've got a scale. And so if my horse is above a 3 out of 10 anxious, they're not capable of really learning and absorbing stuff. And so if you got a horse that's say 4 out of 10, then if you're doing dressage, you might work on shoulder in or leg yielding or even flying changes. Or if you're jumping, you might go through a course. Or if you're just working on trailer loading, you might get your horse on the trailer. But if they're above a 3, to me, they're not going to learn anything. Like, you might have done everything, but they're not going to be better the next day because of it. And so, you know, a 3 on my scale, which is sort of the borderline, is where you could trot on the buckle. And this doesn't apply to every horse, but, you know, a typical event horse would be pretty true for. You can trot on the buckle, and if they keep breaking into the canter, they're probably getting slightly above a 3. And I think that's pretty common. If they're below a 3, then you could trot around on the buckle, and they would just stay in a lovely, relaxed trot, you know, without speeding up and constantly changing their rhythm. And so when I start a horse, I think, can I walk, trot, and canter on the buckle? And if I just relax, I just take a deep breath, will the horse decelerate and break down from the canter to the trot, or the trot to the walk, or the walk to the halt? And then at home, I have that same idea. Can I walk, trot, and canter on the buckle every time before I either get my horse on the bit or before I jump anything? And then when I start going to shows, I have that same idea. Before I go into the dressage ring, or before I go in a jumper class, or before I go cross country, in whatever warm-up area I'm in, could I walk, trot, and canter on the buckle? And if I pay attention to that and make that a priority right from the beginning, then I've got a pretty relaxed horse as the levels move up, and all of a sudden they're in a much better mindset to learn. And of course, I don't always actually go through those steps of walking, trotting, and cantering on the buckle, but I always want to feel like I could do that if I wanted to.
And now that's applying generally to horses with all different temperaments, and obviously that will take a little bit longer then before you can leave home and do that, Tick, if some horses that are particularly skittish.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely takes longer, but I think it takes longer in the first year, but it probably speeds things up, you know, in every year after that. You know, the stronger the foundation that I have, the quicker, you know, the levels go, the more I get out of, you know, paying for a dressage lesson or a jumping lesson, and the faster everything else goes after that. So, you know, to me, it's worth it.
So that's a great tip, that riding on the buckle then through the through the different gates and transitions. Let's think, maybe summarize then, Tick, now with maybe some takeaways for our listeners here. Maybe let's choose 3. What of your techniques for taking starting a horse into competition?
Right. I think the first thing is to just pay attention to their relaxation and to their anxiety, which is a little bit what we just talked about. And I think the second thing is to be aware of the difference between a horse that's excited. We use that word excited all the time. And be aware that there's a difference between a horse that's excited out of anxiety and a horse that's excited out of play or exuberance. And sometimes when I see horses going cross country and they're running at jumps, and people say, oh, the horse is excited and loves cross country, I'm just shaking my head. And I'm saying that horse is just anxious. You know, they're not excited. Whereas you do get horses as well that are excited. But to me, I would probably use a different word for that. You know, I might use they're playful or they're exuberant or they're happy or they're enjoying their work. And that's a horse that also has energy as well, but it's a different kind of energy. And then the next thing is that when I work with horses, right from a lower level all the way up to a higher level, is I become very aware of not only what the work I'm doing, what's the work that I'm doing with the horse, but where is their energy level. And I want to get good at smoothly and easily and quickly raising their energy level. And that's, for example, doing a walk to canter transition and then 10 seconds later coming to a jump, but also smoothly and quickly and easily lowering their energy level. And that would be, you know, after you've done, you know, an extended canter in the dressage ring, and then you can do a free walk across the diagonal, and then you can leave the arena on a loose rein as the crowd is cheering. And I think at the beginning, I'm very slow to change the energy level. Whatever energy level they give me, I'm going to work with it. But then as the years progress and my, you know, the maturity of that relationship, my relationship with the horse, comes along, then I'm more likely to start to change their energy levels. And I actually practice those transitions in and out of energy levels. And it becomes something that's very important to me.
Well, finally, then, to summarize, Kit, if you were to give us your elevator pitch, what would your elevator pitch be for people that should buy your book? What would you say to them?
I think just that, you know, I've put a lot of time and energy, and I put a lot of heart and a lot of soul into this book. And I think Trafalgar Square Books, with Rebecca and Martha, the people that I've worked with there, a small publishing company in Vermont, we've all kind of put our heart and soul into this. And I think it's, you know, for me, it's a very special book, and it means a lot, and it comes from a very personal place, almost a vulnerable place. And I just want to share my story with you, and I think, you know, I hope that you'll enjoy it.
And the title again, in the middle, are The Horsemen. When is it available, Tick?
It's available next week, actually, the beginning of June. So I think people can take pre-orders right now, and I think, you know, in a couple of days they're going to be able to order it, and it'll be on your doorstep just a couple of days after that.
Wonderful. And where would they go to for more information or to pre-order the book, Tick? Is it on your website?
Yeah, it's on my website. It'll also be on Amazon and hopefully in Barnes & Noble and in all your local tack shops and bookstores. But getting it online, the best place is horseandriderbooks.com. It's Trafalgar Square Books, which is the same company that did, you know, Philip Dutton's book and Doug Payne's book. And they've done a lot of horse books over the years, and they do a very good job. They know exactly what they're doing.
They certainly do. Well, Tick, congratulations again on publishing the book, and the very best of luck to you. Thank you for taking the time to come on the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Tick Maynard for coming on the show this week. You can, of course, listen to this and other episodes of the podcast by downloading it from iTunes and other podcast stores to your favorite podcast player. And be sure to follow us on social media for news of when the latest episode is available, as well as all the other news here from the USCA. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another episode of the USCA's official podcast. Until then, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world, and enjoy your eventing.